Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute, either explicitly or implicitly, any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. I'm Brett Winton. We have a great show for you this week. With me here, we have Charlie Roberts, who is our chief investment strategist and key in our venture strategies, leading that whole effort. And then Chase Prather. And together we're talking to Peter Walker, who is with Carta, the cap table management company that produces a lot of reports on kind of like the underlying mechanics of what's going on in the venture industry. Chase, tell us kind of like, one, what you see happening in venture on the ground working with companies here at ARK. And then Charlie, I'm going to ask you how, if your perspective as a former founder as to what's happening in venture as well. Chase, take the mic.
Yeah, I think one of the, you know, there's a couple of things that are pretty obvious to most people that are working in venture day in, day out right now. And it's really on both sides of the street. So for funds themselves, and then also for the startups, we're seeing a very small percentage of companies and a very small percentage of funds getting majority of the capital allocated to them. Whereas we're seeing these smaller startups and these smaller fund managers struggle to raise capital. I think that's, we're seeing a bit of a shift just in general when it comes to the overall funding environment. I think the way that startups are starting to operate, they're starting to shift their mindsets a bit as well to become profitable at an earlier stage or potentially raise less rounds than traditional. You look at companies that were started 10, you know, even now there's still private companies that were started, you know, 30 years ago, and they're still raising capital. And they're on their Series I, and there's, you know, Series W at this point. And we, you know, some of these startups are, you know, it's Series A, and they're profitable. They don't need to raise another dollar if they don't want to. And I think that it's positive in a lot of ways for the overall environment. But I think as we see these mega funds being raised and majority of capital, the large majority of capital going to 10 to 15 allocators, we're losing the point of what venture was founded on, which is seeking alpha. And it's hard to seek alpha and try to have a fund returning investment in a startup that isn't going to be a potential fund returner. And if you're only making investments in companies that have the potential to be trillion-dollar companies, you're still missing out on a lot of these companies that could, you know, that are home runs. Maybe it's not a grand slam, or maybe you're hitting a triple and you have a $300 million return on a company you invested in the seed stage, but you're avoiding that investment because your fund is $20 billion and you can't return a fund on that investment. So it's, you know, the math's just not mathing at that point.
Charlie, from someone who's been through the process of number of times of trying to line up venture funding for various rounds, what do you think it's like on the ground for operators given the funding environment here? And how do you think about it?
I mean, as Chase says, I think we're seeing an increasingly Pareto sort of dynamic. So I think a lot of, and some of it disappears, right? Because there's a whole long tail of companies that are not getting funded. And then the ones that are getting funded are getting funded fine in many cases. But as Chase says, I think you've got a Pareto dynamic both in the companies and in the funds themselves. And as you say, I've lived through easier and harder funding rounds, including like a $300 million Series D that we did a few years ago for Freenome. As Peter says in the piece, the macro environment matters a lot, right? And especially around the supply and demand dynamics. So who's entering, who's feeling flush, who's investing, that whole dynamic as well, as we talk about with whether crossover investors and public market even investors are investing in privates or not. Sometimes when they all leave, then it can very much change. I think I've been surprised in the last couple of years with a fairly hostile funding environment in many respects, how well the very early stage valuations, even for some seed companies, have held up. It's almost like a company is getting funded or not. And if it is being funded, if it's in that Pareto distribution, actually the valuations haven't really dipped, at least from what I've seen, in many cases. In fact, some sectors have definitely gone up, and it's been very also tilted, as we discussed, with AI. Now, there's an interesting discussion about every company in some number of years, maybe, arguably an AI company or a non-existent company. And then it's like, what's a true AI company versus an AI-friendly company versus an AI company whose data might be, or a traditional company whose data might be useful for AI versus a laggard, right? So it's like, and where does a company on that spectrum, and how well does it do, in some cases, sadly, quite smoke and mirrors, and in some cases, probably undersold. So without getting too off topic, I think, following the talent in that regard is proving to be one of the only ways you can really find out.
I also think, Charlie, with the AI spike that's happening right now and all of the commotion around these large LLMs, I think that people are starting to wake up and understand, like, oh, I would love to be an investor in this company or this company. And then they try to go look it up on, Robinhood or wherever they do their investing, and they can't find it. And they search and they find out it's a private company, and they kind of go down this rabbit hole of finding out what venture capital is, looking into it more. And then they're trying to find a way to invest, and they still can't invest because they're not accredited. And I think that that switch is starting to happen, where people are really starting to wake up and understand, like, oh, this is something I can't do. Now I'm mad about it because they didn't even know they couldn't do it before. And just the general population, people, retail investors are becoming a lot more educated around this. And I think that I hope that there's going to be some kind of a shift in general around that.
Right, with also a growing number of kind of decacorns and beyond, as we're seeing with the Anthropics of this world, obviously Stripe, and other, but especially in AI, you've got Anthropic, OpenAI, now Mistral, all these companies making those kinds of valuations. And more importantly, to your point, public awareness. So people are looking for those companies. They know they're big, maybe assuming they're going to be public. And as you say, almost so many of the interesting companies, certainly in AI, are still private. I don't think.
It's funny. It occurs to me that there's like an intersection here where like the venture market as a whole is probably more macro cyclically sensitive than it ever has been, because it is relatively larger compared to kind of the broad public equity market than it ever has been. So like, if you think about during the dot-com bust, venture funding was way down, of course, and I'm sure it had an impact on the industry, but it was such a smaller dollar figure relative to rest of industry that kind of you didn't necessarily have the severe impact across a lot of companies that were counting on kind of like continuously raising, venture funding or raising venture funding to get to scale. During the dot-com bust, those companies were public and they bankrupted. Like, they died in droves. What's interesting about the venture market is, like, not only that is happening. I mean, in the interview, Peter says that they had the most Carter companies they've ever had actually cease to exist. But also within the private market, there's the ability to conceal what's actually happening, or at least delay and pretend it's not happening for a longer period of time. And so we don't actually have quite as much transparency into what's happening under the covers for a lot of these companies that raised money in 2021 that now haven't come back to market. Well, essentially because they can't get the value they got before. But also it's like, they probably aren't delivering on metrics sufficient to even get the value that was underwritten in 21 in any meaningful sense. And so kind of like that money is probably, sunk or burned capital, but that hasn't yet been unveiled. And that feeds all the way back into the investor side, where investors, LPs, have put money into these things, but maybe they haven't really been actually marked to market. And so it just seems like the private markets being as big as they are means that the macro cycle kind of washes through in this really longer and messier way than kind of in 2001, where you basically instantaneously saw who was naked when the tide came out. Here the tide has come out, but like everybody's wearing like, you know, little screens in front of them. You're like, are you naked? And most of them are, you know.
I think there are also some constraints and things that are not immediately obvious, even to many in venture and I think in private markets until you get to the later stages. So to your question about what I've seen, you know, by the time of fundraising for Freenome, by the late rounds, you know, raising a $300 million Series D, you're mainly speaking to the big crossover investors who are otherwise, they're either in funds that mainly are known for their public investments or they are actually crossover investors, by and large, well, kind of both. So the interesting thing I learned there when 2022 came around and I was still speaking to the same analysts and PMs who were making those investments, a lot of them just could not invest in privates, whereas a year ago they were. And partly it was because of their fund mandates that controlled the percent they could be public and private exposed. Now, when all the public book went down, they literally were told to exit the public for the private positions they had and not make any new ones. So suddenly you've got billions of dollars leaving the late stage privates immediately, which is kind of to your point about the tide going out. And I think there's a lot of these dynamics and constraints that have gone on behind the scenes that have really changed things because the overall numbers in privates have got so big. And so the buy and selling dynamic has an impact like it never has had before.
In that case, it's in their benefit to mark to market in one way, even though they would be having to mark their book down and take a loss on some of these private companies, but it would also open up the opportunity for them to double down in some of these private names if they're marking to market, because it balances the portfolio appropriately to what it actually should be priced at.
Well, but there it depends upon like what is, you know, often kind of like venture strategies have a separate pricing committee. If the pricing committee is not designed around like marking that's closer to how you mark public companies, which is kind of like, then you wait for them to raise the next round and then you mark it. But then the private company is going to prevent themselves from raising the next round because they can't take that down round. And so it just delays actually the realization event, even though that's preventing kind of investors from moving in. There's both kind of like maybe structural impedance to that or impediments to that. And also, you know, if you've lost a lot of money for an investor and you can delay telling them that you've lost a lot of money, usually your incentive is to delay. Because maybe it turns around by the time you have to tell them, you have to be like, oh, this was fine. And so I just feel like the industry is generally incentivized not to reveal when something does poorly.
I do think that, you know, people like Peter and even Ilya and that we spoke to on the last podcast we did together, Brett, they're really starting to open up the curtain for a lot of the retail investors and also a lot of founders to understand like, oh, I'm not the only one that's going through this same situation, or I'm not the only person that's raising it a down round, and also giving the information to, you know, potentially some of these LPs and GPs, but I would say more so the LPs to understand this fund that I invested in 2021 might be, you know, not doing the best at this point, but I need to look at my returns on a longer term. And these cycles are a bit cyclical. And just because this is a down year that we had, you know, from these funds in 2021, the potential of it having an up year, you know, over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, it's not like they're bad investments. It's just they were overvalued when people came into them. And those companies bouncing back is still something that could potentially happen.
Well, right. Like overvalued in the context of the macro at that time and what people thought the macro was going to do kind of thing. It's kind of hard to plan around. Quickly before we wrap up as well, and Brett, sorry, unless you were going to say something else, I just wanted to pick up on a definition that Peter does introduce in the talk. And he talked about DPI, which as folks will appreciate and could look up, but is distributed to paid in terms of distributed to paid in capital, which measures the amount of capital distributed back to investors, LPs or limited partners, relative to the total money contributed in order to give insight into liquidity and realization of returns. So generated by the VC fund so that you can pin that against time and really try and figure out where that investment is going and how it's compounding. And we cover lots of interesting stuff about around secondaries, and you know, that's a much longer and deeper conversation. As it happens, I just got off the phone literally an hour before this with an early stage venture fund who'd be interested in and LP checks, fund of funds, which we do. Yeah. But their whole business model is actually to do a shorter length fund than most have historically done. And their whole goal is to actually get out by secondaries, mainly to their own LPs. So there's these whole business models emerging around this too. And not, you know, how can we not lock capital up for quite so long, largely to improve that DPI. Obviously the best way is good multiples in record time. So,
which goes exactly against what Peter said people should be thinking through as right. well. So we do want to, yeah.
Right. The longer term, yeah. and as we know, the hockey sticks come later. So it's, you know, speak to most VCs and most LPs, and they wish they, you know, many at least, wish they could have held for many, many more years to catch the end of that hockey stick. That has also backfired and people have tried it.
Yeah, I think it depends on which hockey stick you're holding, perhaps.
Yes.
Okay, well, enjoy the conversation with Peter, and thank you for joining FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. Peter Walker, welcome to the FYI podcast for your innovation. Peter, you do lots of out-reporting of all of the great data that Carta has on venture funding and the state of the venture market at various time points. Can you lay out the current state of play in venture and venture funding for us? What are you noticing? What are the trends? What should we anticipate over the course of this year?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. So Carta serves, 50,000 or so US-based startups. Not exactly sure what the market share is, but a hefty portion of all US startups end up managing their cap table on Carta. So that's how we have this information to aggregate and anonymize and then kind of report out on. Big headlines. So 2024 didn't feel good from a venture funding standpoint unless you were, one of 10 AI companies. But it actually was an improvement from 2023. 2023, we saw like $75 billion invested into Carta startups. 24, it's more like 85 or 86, getting a little bit better, but nowhere near the sort of level of investment that we saw in 2021 when everyone went a little bit wild. Other headlines, I think that there's an idea that early stage has been sort of protected from a lot of the turmoil, and late stage is where all the carnage is happening. Actually, early stage also kind of fell behind in terms of pace of investment last year and in 23. So it's kind of a struggle across the board. Like, venture funding is just much harder than it was 2 years ago, no matter if you're at seed or at pre-IPO. And then the final story, of course, that we can't avoid is how AI is affecting these metrics. Something like 30 to 35% of every dollar invested last year went to an AI company. And if you look at late stage, that's more like 50 cents on every dollar invested went to an AI company. So it's the hype cycle. Remains to be seen whether or not it's a bubble that pops or if it's real material wealth that's being generated. But everyone's talking about it and it's just showing up in the numbers all over the place.
And the other thing that I lifted from some of your reports is there's also this funny thing happening on the GP side or kind of like the venture investor side and the LP side, where the value paid out from value invested into later stage vintage rounds, which were started around this time frame, has really dried up, which I think from the investor side, it's like, oh, this was the thing where I put in money and I got out money so I could put in more money. Now suddenly the money stopped coming out. And so that seems to like ramify into kind of venture funding generally.
Totally. I mean, it's the vending machine where you're just like pounding on the front of it to get the peanuts out of there and no peanuts are dropping, even though you put in a bunch of cash. Like, that's where we are right now in venture, no doubt. I think that our fund performance data, which is a data set of 1,800 or so venture funds in the US. And the interesting part about our data is that it's a lot of it's focused on venture funds that are under 100 million in AUM. So emerging managers, fund two, fund three, that kind of people. Whereas some of the other benchmarks are much more focused on the Andreessens and the upmarket people in the world. The basic takeaway is, yes, DPI is down. Of course, if you're expecting DPI in 3 years from a venture fund, you're in the wrong business. Like, you just don't understand how venture works. But even so, more recent vintages that are 5, 6, 7 years old, a fewer percentage of funds have any DPI to show, even at those stages. So no matter where you look, this downturn there was such a decline in funding and overvaluations and down rounds and all that stuff, it had to start showing up in the fund numbers, and it has. And so now the question remains, what do LPs think of this asset class moving forward? You know, this year, all the stories were about them basically only investing in the top name brand funds and having very little appetite to invest into emerging managers. We'll see if that holds. You know, there's a big debate about whether you can get super high returns from $2, $3 billion plus funds in the private markets. I think that's still an open question. So interesting times to live in. We're all just kind of sitting here knocking on wood for some IPOs.
It seems that I would say, you know, recently you've been one of the most quoted people when it comes to statistics on LinkedIn and Twitter or X across the board. When it comes to anyone referring back to returns on funds and so on and so forth. Take me through the process of you sitting down, you have all of this data, and you want to say, what insights do I want to pull out of this? You know, how are you going through that?
In some ways, it's dictated by what we're hearing from the market. So, you know, we began this insights practice in the company level data, and it was four founders trying to give them a little bit. You know, we started with the idea that a founder should walk into a negotiation with a VC armed with as much data as the VC is. But that's rapidly expanded beyond that to fund manager questions, LP questions, et cetera. So my job is pretty awesome. I get to respond to people asking me for data that I'm pretty sure I have, which is usually great. The stuff that really hits, though, is when you either point out something that people assumed was true but couldn't prove, or you point out a contrary point that, you know, this standard idea about venture doesn't really work. The biggest thing for me about our fund data set that like sparked a bunch of conversations is just, I think that the idea of this asset class as a 10-year fund lifecycle makes no sense in today's market. If a VC is pitching the fund to be wrapped up neatly with a bow in 10 years, they don't really understand how venture works these days. It's much more like 12, 13, 14, 15 years in order to see full performance and judge it that way. And when you add that extra 5-year period to a fund life, you have to make materially different assumptions about the level of performance required to justify the illiquidity. So I think what's happened to venture over the last 5 years is a major shift from where it was before. It's become an institutionalized professional place. And we can almost talk about venture as two or three separate markets now, with late stage resembling PE and early stage still being more adventure capital. I don't think that our words haven't caught up to the way that the industry is working at the moment.
There's been a lot of hype around, you know, the different stages, especially around secondary markets, which I know, you know, Carta dabbled in a bit. Do you think the secondary markets are actually, you know, picking up as much as people say they are? Or do you think that because the transfer restrictions on some of these share classes, they might not ever fully pick up?
They won't ever fully pick up. There's no replacement for a healthy functioning IPO market. It just doesn't exist for liquidity. Now, are there more interesting things happening in secondaries now than there have been in a long time? Yeah, for sure. There's cool and interesting experiments happening. You know, Cardex shut down, but we still see a lot of secondary transactions because we are the system of record for the cap. So we can notice bilateral transactions are more likely. You run a tender offer. I think the biggest thing that's changed and why secondaries are so much more in the news is that the latest stage privates who are the most in-demand names, and we could all go through the top five, you know, SpaceX, et cetera, they have sort of pioneered this new model where they can give employees liquidity at regular intervals whenever they want to because they have access to as much private capital as they need. And that strikes me as really worrisome if your goal is to have those companies ever IPO. Like, what is the value of IPO to a Stripe? What do they gain from it? I struggle to find one thing that's better for the founders by doing that, if they have unlimited access to private capital and can make their employees whole in terms of liquidity.
I would argue, as somebody who, I mean, we do public markets and private markets, so we have a dog in both hunts, but that for kind of the AI companies, for SpaceX, for even for Stripe, for companies that are providing really global infrastructure that is going to touch every consumer's life and has profound impact, there is political support that comes alongside allowing individuals to invest in those companies. It actually becomes increasingly valuable to the companies as they scale. And so you can imagine, take the frontier model AI companies, you know, of which, you know, we're really interested in, invested in a number of them. Those companies, I think, are going to become, they're going to need kind of like the political will of a public shareholding class, I think. And also possibly will also need to, the kind of transparency that comes with the IPO process will be important for them maintaining kind of like that political will, not just capitalized, but in terms of like how it signals to the market that people can understand what's going on underneath the company, that they're fully disclosing everything they're doing. I think that those will become important tools. Now, I think Elon in particular has had some pretty sour experiences with, you know, his publicly listed entity. I mean, you know, he yep. literally had, I mean, I don't know what the Delaware courts did to Tesla. I think it's like actually severely impairs public capital formation in the US, not least because it means he's like, I'm not interested in doing this with SpaceX or Neuralink. This yep. seems like a crazy thing to do, you know? Yep. And I think that there is like kind of value in that public shareholding class and the basically transparency that comes alongside that. So I do think that there's some, like, even if you have unlimited capital, like there's reasons to be public. And even in Tesla, you know, when they were struggling with the Model 3 program, investors came out and helped them deliver vehicles because they had, you know, equity in the fight. And so I think, you know, figuring out ways for people to have meaningful equity positions in these companies is useful for the companies in a broad sense, regardless of whether or not they have unlimited capital.
I think, though, that as models emerge, and you know, we are seeing a lot of innovation in the provision of the private capital markets, you know, among, you know, obviously Republic, SoFi, you've got a lot of players there. We are bringing people like over 10,000 people already, individual investors, to the problem, who we hope ultimately become those kind of army of allies, like you've got with the Tesla Model 3 owners who also own Tesla stock. And so maybe that's a gateway question into, what are you seeing, if anything, that you think really has the potential to disrupt the venture industry as has been against this backdrop of a rising secondary market, you know, this ongoing problem with emerging managers who often are merit capital and are really trying to return a fund many times over. And then you've got these mega funds that have attracted so much capital that are almost, I mean, they are also trying to get great returns, but they're also having great revenues anyway, right? Just on the management fee. So obviously incentives may drift, not saying they do or will with many funds, but how are you thinking about that emerging? Like, what are the disruptive technologies within venture itself that is disrupting something that's looking to back disruptive technologies, maybe?
Yeah, it's a meta turtles all the way down, you know?
Right.
I love the, so to the first point, Brett, I actually hadn't considered deeply the political, and maybe political is maybe not even the right words, but like the community aspect of going public. I think that's the first pushback that I've heard to this that resonates with me. So that's, I need to think about that more often, more deeply. To the point on like how is venture changing? I think that the split this year has started to really get people thinking about what VC should be. And by the split, I mean the haves and the have-nots in terms of new funds raised versus the mega funds versus emerging managers. I don't think it's ever been as stark, the difference between those two things. And as you mentioned, the varied goals perhaps or motivations behind fundraising on one end or the other. So there's minor changes that may be happening for emerging managers. So one thing that we're hearing a lot more is that emerging managers are no longer assuming that the growth path for their firm, not their fund, goes up in AUM. We're hearing a lot more people saying, look, I want to build a firm and I want to raise the exact same size fund every time because I want to, quote unquote, stick to my knitting. I want to invest where I'm great and understand where I need to get off the train. Two, I do think that the increased level of secondaries has made it slightly more acceptable, or there's less stigma around early investors getting off before IPO as well. So there should be more exit paths. I think that's very healthy for the market. The third is, you know, when it comes to these late stage names, we've already seen, you know, there's there's Destiny, there's other funds that are kind of like, I actually haven't looked legally very much into Destiny. I don't know what they're doing exactly with those like five or six names and concentrating a lot of, you know, crossover capital or retail capital into the idea that you can own some SpaceX shares before they IPO. I think we're going to see an explosion of ideas around that sector. So can you build private market indexes in any way? You know, I think there's a lot of appetite to have exposure to privates without actual ownership. And maybe there's some financial engineering that needs to happen in order to make that work. But it feels kind of like everything's up in the air in a way that it hasn't been for a while, just because we've come to this choke point of, you know, lack of LP capital really makes people think about new ways of doing things.
You had mentioned one of your favorite things is finding these contrarian views that people originally thought was right, and then you actually pull the data and everyone's been wrong about something.
Yep.
What is one of those views that you've found in the last year or so?
Well, when I talk to early stage founders, one of the most consensus things here in Silicon Valley that they talk about is that we need to split equity 50-50 between myself and my co-founder if I have a two-founder team, or even 33-33-33 if I'm a three-founder team. And like our data, we put out a lot of data on this, just doesn't agree at all. Most teams don't split equally at upfront, and beyond that, most teams do not stay equal as you go through the funding rounds and people shift roles and change and leave and et cetera. So when you get to IPO, it's actually very rare to find a two-founder team that has exactly equal ownership. So that's one thing that keeps, you know, ownership becomes a very close proxy for like worth. and it becomes very emotional for founders, as it totally should over time. The other point that, you know, we talk about, or that comes up a lot in terms of ownership, we talk about venture capital. You've probably seen it in the headlines recently. Whenever there's a company that shuts down and the proximate cause or the founder that started the company is no longer with the firm, we can talk about bench in this case. There's this story that comes out that's like the big bad VCs took away the CEO and killed the golden goose. And if they just hadn't done that, everything would have been fine. I think that in many cases, that's not necessarily true, but we are starting to see like the biggest thing that founders are asking us for this year is, how should I think about control? Like, how much capital do I need? Should I try at all costs to hold on to 50% plus one of ownership? What is the ways that I can ensure that I am not fired from my own company? Those aren't like a myth that needs to be disproved, but it's like this messy area where there's so many different opinions about what's right and what's not right. We're releasing data today and tomorrow on this kind of stuff, but it's really, I think that the fact that venture hasn't returned as well as it should have over the last 2 years has made a lot of founders think about whether or not they want to be venture-backed at all, or if they are venture-backed, do I do one round and done, or like try some different model than just following through the alphabet?
Have you seen that control, the difference with sort of super voting and things, different by sector and by industry as well? Because I come originally from bio. It's extremely rare. And yeah. I've often put that down to the fact that you often don't have very hard endpoints in the way you've not got MAUs or DAUs or revenue ramping or whatever. And those are usually the things that allow founders to get 10x, 15x voting. And whereas in bio, you have none of that. It's unknown until it's in the clinic or something. So I've seen very little. I presume that was why in bio, but maybe you've got another perspective on it.
It's actually fairly rare across the board. I think we talk a lot about the companies that have it because those are the companies that get spoken about sort of by definition. But it's actually, you know, super control or multiple voting classes where the founders are privileged over all investors. It's fairly rare. I mean, it's a little bit more common in some of these AI companies than it used to be, et cetera. But across the board, it's still a question of ownership and when are you going to give up the control of this company to investors as a group, not a solo investor, obviously. And that's, you know, most startups, that happens like Series B, you know, Series A, Series B. It's happening. And because so many companies are raising on safes and pre-seed before they even get to seed rounds these days, actually the time at which that control flips has gotten a little bit earlier than it used to be, which is, I think, a little different than people might expect.
And have you seen actually, the sort of old rules of thumb about generally every round you'd raise, I mean, broadly say between 10 and 50%. dilution, but maybe more normally between 20, 33%, something like that.
Yeah.
As companies potentially get more efficient with AI and maybe spend less because they're hiring less and all, have you seen that dynamic begin to change? You know, I've got loads of people who think we're going to, you know, in the next decade or something, see the first, you know, 10-person, $100 billion company. And that's maybe an extreme example, but even a trend towards that would be very different from where we've been. And obviously that has a massive impact on burn and therefore on capital and dilution choices. Do you think you've seen the green shoots of that come through, or is that still a ways off and it's just theoretical?
I think we're starting to see peaks of it, yes. You know, whether late stage venture, I think, is an interesting question. So on the how are founders building companies side, I think one of the clearest patterns that we saw from our compensation data, we track about 800,000 private market employees, is that startups are just scrutinizing every single hire far more closely than they did 2 years ago. So what does that mean for companies themselves? If you look at our data, if you raised a Series A round in the first half of 2021, you probably had something like 20 to 22 full-time equity holding employees. If you raised the company that raised that same Series A in the first half of 2024 had something like 15 employees. And I think by the end of the year, it's probably going to be more like 13.
Wow, so that is an interesting insight. Huge difference.
Yeah. Now, again, that's full-time equity holders. So that doesn't mean that they replaced them with AI. They could have offshore, they could consultant, fractional. There's like other ways of doing this. But I do think it points to a general trend, which is the, you know, the bandied about metric of ARR per employee is not some vague term. People are using it to judge businesses in a way they hadn't been before. And founders have internalized that for sure.
I had a quick question, then I'll hand the mic back to Brett and Chase. Just going back to secondaries for a second, have you seen, my hope is that for some markets, thinking internationally and particularly with Europe, which has been, you know, so far behind, particularly I'm just thinking of the UK ecosystem because I spend time in it. My hope is that potentially, you know, but the same thought would apply to all sorts of geographies around the world. The secondaries market would allow and enable people to take more virtuous risk and actually build scaled companies. You know, obviously we're going to see many, many more scaled companies in the US, and that's the right thing. But as well as that, you know, building proper unicorns and things globally without feeling the pressure to sort of flip at that 300, 400, 500, 600 million kind of buyout time. I don't know if you've seen that or whether that's just, you know, a theoretical potential. But my hope is that that would allow more distribution of the building of quite scaled companies without the flip. But I don't know, if that's come true yet.
I wouldn't say that we've seen it materially different from prior years in terms of the, you know, percentage of companies that start overseas and then come to the US or vice versa. I am equally hopeful that there's, you know, more late actual scale markets in places that are not the US. I think that would be fantastic. Where Carta serves startups in like 80 countries now. So we would love to see that as well. But, you know, I feel like sometimes Europe gets the short end of the stick conversationally on X and other places, perhaps even more than it should, but there's still obviously a difference in scale being applied.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Do you think that in both within Carta's kind of strategic ambitions, and clearly you've made some moves to support public market kind of cap table conversions and stuff, and you can imagine that kind of like smart contracting protocols and platforms should allow basically anything to be securitized, but including private companies more efficiently. If we're thinking about a way that venture funding could change, if, you know, Trump can launch a meme coin, then surely like a Stripe equity can be wrapped into a token. Are you seeing anything that indicates that is actually going to occur? And are you all planning on doing that or even moving in that direction to accommodate, you know, some of the exposures we look to are equity, and there's also token exposure that's matched with that. And so if tokens become a mechanism by which to capitalize businesses, then clearly people need to figure out how those fit into a balance sheet or cap table management as well.
Totally. Yeah, there's certainly a bunch of crypto funds and crypto companies that use Carta and then have interactions between their equity cap tables and their token books, and those are kind of functioning separate ways. It's not, I don't think we are spending a ton of time on it at the moment. Maybe we have the wrong product priorities. But I do think that it's something that will happen. I mean, to your point, the fact that the president can launch a meme coin and then a second meme coin for his wife, the first lady, like right before the election, and I can't invest in a startup for my friend because I'm not an accredited investor. It does seem odd that we like allow certain kinds of risk, but are like very prudish about other kinds of risk. That has always struck us at Carta as very strange. So even beyond the crypto use case, you know, having more and more people be able to participate in private markets, given the things that you're already able to participate in, I think is a policy goal that we share.
What are your thoughts on accreditation status in general and the laws around it?
I would point you to our wonderful policy team who's written a lot of stuff about this. But I like, you know, some of it is really basic analysis where you look at the percentage of people under the current accreditation thresholds that could invest into private markets, and you're like, well, you're just ensconcing a coastal elite at that point. Like,
right.
You are by definition, based on where capital lives, leaving out a lot of people who could benefit from this ownership. And obviously it does not come without risk, but you know, neither does your favorite Dogecoin.
It's also something of a tax on the extremes of age, right? Like it's quite easy to be an accredited investor if you've worked hard and you're in your 40s or 50s, right? A lot of people just meet that just where they are on the curve, but it's not age assessed. So it's very hard to be an accredited investor if you're self-made, if you're 20-something, 30-something even, or indeed in your 60s or 70s or whatever, and you're retired. So it is actually a tax on the young and the, you know, the old in some ways as well. So that's also, you know, something, as well as obviously a huge tax on people from less advantaged backgrounds or who just haven't inherited but might know a ton and be super leaned in and interested. And it's just, it takes them 10 or 20 years to earn, to get onto the curve at which they're allowed to invest in one of the best compounding places, which is the private markets, which, yeah, we would agree makes little sense or certainly is due of an upgrade.
Hear, hear. Well said. We'll argue in front of Congress together for it, I guess.
One other thing I wanted to ask before, I don't know how close we are on time, but before we wrap up quick, yeah, is around you'd mentioned people commonly are worried about founders themselves are worried about being pushed off their company, losing their leadership roles there and having professional CEOs come and replace them. I want to say it was you. You know, there's maybe like two other people that I follow that post as many good insights as you. So it's a small group, but
thank you.
Posted a statistics around founder-led companies, not only in the private markets, but also in the public markets being, I want to say it was close to like 12x more successful these companies are versus the companies that are led by professional CEOs. Have you any insight in that?
So that must have not been me, but I appreciate that. When you think of insights, you're thinking of me first. That's very kind. I haven't seen that chart, but I would be completely unsurprised by that finding. There is a little bit of survivorship bias there, obviously, right? So yes, you know, when you're talking about the actual enterprise value of a company and you're including founder-led, you know, are you including Apple? Like there's distinctions here that are probably difficult to make sometimes, and it only takes into account the ones that actually succeeded. So on a percentage basis, I don't know, but in most cases, I think, and certainly at Carta, we would assume, you know, founders are going to know probably best in most cases, and bringing in professional CEOs to really can be a pathway to taking away enterprise value, case by case, of course.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like if you're a, you know, the founder gets deposed because something has gone wrong along the way. They've had to raise too much capital, you know, and so then right, it's kind of like a company that is not on momentum trajectory generally. And I think that there's totally valid, it's not just that the founder knows better, it's just that they can act. As yeah, in, if if they have enough internal credibility to say, this is what we're going to do, and then that converts enough of the team behind them to like actually do the thing. Whereas if you bring in professional management, you can end up with essentially employee resistors or people that it just doesn't feel aligned in the same way. And so then it's harder for the company as a whole entity to make, you know, real decisions. And I think a lot of, you know, the startups die by inaction, not by action, right? And or kind of paralysis rather than by like boldly stepping forward. And so I do think that that's a kind of like...
I think that point that founder privilege doesn't just apply to the things that you do, but it also applies to the way in which you can bring along employees, I think is completely well said. And it's difficult to, you really can't, there's no other way to get that than by being the founder.
If you look at some of the founder-led megacap companies that are in the current crop, I think there's a pretty good argument, and maybe part of it is what Brett said there, that some of them have at least either beaten or at least mitigated the traditional innovator's dilemma, like getting to a scale that they've got to and still staying ahead of the pack in so many ways. Obviously, unsurprisingly, probably we would put Tesla very high up on that list. But there are others, right, that have got to a massive scale and still staying relatively nimble and driving incredible product innovation. So, you know, that it's exciting to see that. And, you know, I think AI and the augmentation of great founders will just hopefully amplify that even more.
I think Zuckerberg agrees with you with the way that he was talking about Apple in that recent interview. I guess I don't know if that was specifically founder-led or not founder-led commentary, but it kind of felt pointed.
felt a bit attack. Yeah. I'm curious to see, you know, the data you've pulled recently, if you've seen an uptick in kind of a zombie companies just in general, and if there's a point where companies are kind of hitting that milestone. Is it around Series A, Series B, where companies are starting to get stuck and not be able to raise more capital, and they're just kind of coasting until they burn out, or maybe they coast forever and they're never really crazy profitable. They don't really, you know.
It strikes me as a difficult number or figure to pull, just because it's very difficult to know whether a company is not raising by choice or by dearth of available options. However, yes, I would say that there's a glut of companies, especially at seed and Series A, for whom the bell hasn't tolled yet, but certainly things are not looking positive there. 2.5-3 years from their most recent raise, they may have undertaken a lot of different changes to the business so that they're close to break even, but the growth has stopped. And then you're caught between this rock and a hard place. And if you took venture capital, you know, the prospects are very slim there, in a way that if you had never taken venture capital, then you could just continue eking out some growth. And maybe there's an acquisition in your future. You know, we had more companies shut down, more Carta companies shut down in 2024 than at any other year we looked at, which is kind of to be expected, given we funded a ton of companies in 21. So unless VCs got way better at choosing the right companies, if we funded more companies in 21, we'd have expect more shutdowns 3 years hence. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
And do you see through to like a debt on the cap table with Carta as well?
We don't have a ton of information on debt, actually. It's not super easy to recognize on the cap, but so less good data for you there.
Got it.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on venture debt in general versus traditional venture capital?
Venture debt scares me, unless you actually have some real revenues, in which case you probably don't need it. I don't know. It seems like I don't want to say it's never correct, but perhaps you all would know better than me. I felt like venture debt was becoming more of a regular part of the mix for venture companies up until SVB. And then since SVB weekend, I feel like the major tentpole of that ecosystem has been pulled out. And I don't know if anyone has really stepped in to replace it.
I would.
You know, obviously there's different bank players, et cetera, but like no like central node.
I would agree with that. Yeah. It seems that, and I also agree. I think that, you know, cash-intense businesses are the primary use that you would want to raise venture debt, something like a CPG company. But majority of companies, it's probably not the best bet. We've seen examples of that as well. So,
Peter, I think Carta, as a firm, and as folks have said, you do such a great job of just sharing knowledge in a way that just makes it very helpful for the ecosystem. Is there anything that hasn't happened yet or you would like to see, whether it's Carta stepping in to do or whether it's others? Like, what is missing to drive that innovation opportunity ecosystem?
I do think, and this is not something that Carta has access to today, so this would be perhaps a request for others listening. When we put out all this information on private capital and the flows of cash, what we responded back to from founders oftentimes is, thank you so much for this data on what fundraising looked like, but what about the operations and finances of my own business?
Right. So
like, what is good ARR? How does that change over time? What percentage can we assign a value to an actual incremental dollar of revenue in the eyes of a median valuation, et cetera? And I think a lot of the times, unfortunately, the answer, even if we had the data, would be, sure, this is useful, but it's about the founding team and you are not Brett Taylor. So there's like a little bit of that. But I do think that that's a missing point of like, can you get really good data on cash and how finances work at early stage startups? I would love, selfishly, I would love to read more of that. Outside of that, like, look, I'm all for, I think we need emerging managers. I hope if there's LPs listening that they give a lot of these emerging managers another shot. When we looked at our fund performance data, when we really dug into it, the highest correlation between a fund and its success is the years in which it was investing. So much is driven by the macro environment. So if you got one shot to be a fund manager and you invested all of your capital in 21, the chances that your returns are good are slim to none. And so it's a lot of it about like sticking with this asset class over time, because you kind of have to in order to generate returns that are meaningful.
And maybe to close out, what do you anticipate, putting your head in the crystal ball and with the data that you're seeing over the course of this year, what should we look for, anticipate, fear? What is to come?
I think just as we were speaking a little bit earlier about zombie startups, I do feel, unfortunately, that this is the year of zombie funds, where there are going to be many more folks who have investor in their LinkedIn than are actually investing. We've already started seeing that, but I think it's going to continue. And it can be a waste of time for founders to pitch those people. I don't want to frame this as they're terrible people. I actually feel for those investors who are kind of caught here. So that's one. Two, I would be shocked if we didn't get more IPOs than we did last year, but I would also be equally stunned if we get really, really gigantic IPOs. I think the IPOs that we're going to get this year are going to be decent, but they're not going to be the names that we all want in order to like set off a new rally gun. Acquisitions should go up. They were already trending up at the end of last year, so I'd expect that to continue. And really, now the question is the biggest question is how many of those early AI champions can maintain the pace? Or is this a year where AI companies find that a lot of that early momentum was experiments and not real? I think by the end of the year, we'll have a lot firmer grasp on, is this a revolution or is this another bubble?
We think about this a lot. It's interesting. I think to some of the naysayers who feel like AI is like, oh, AI is not driving productivity and all stuff, there's a pretty big kind of boiling frog situation going on where we're beginning, everyone's using AI every day. We just don't necessarily notice it. And then in 2 years' time, you find that literally everything you're doing, it's already every time you search and then you go to Perplexity or whatever. And maybe just a final thought before we wrap, something triggered that I forgot to ask earlier. Any thoughts on pros and cons of the crossover funds and folks investing in privates who also, there was this big push through 2020, 2021. Obviously, you had a lot of these big crossover entrants, arguably impacted because of the supply and demand dynamics, some of the later stage, the unicorn valuations. And then suddenly 2022 kicked in and all those folks left the building and everything changed. Any last thoughts on that would be super interesting for us, I think.
I think it's less whether or not you, from a completely theoretical perspective, have pros or cons to say about that capital itself. It's more the pace of change swinging in and out of the ecosystem, as you mentioned, that causes these pendulum shifts that like really can screw with people's heads. The prototypical example of the Tiger term sheet with no diligence that just arrives at a founder's desk and with the explicit promise of, we don't want to talk to you. We are just dumb capital. Just use us as needed. That I think has obvious downsides occasionally, but I don't think that the crossover capital is at such a scale right now that it's truly affecting those decisions. To me, the distinction this year and next year is much more about the entrenched venture players and then the emerging venture class. How do LPs distinguish anticipated performance between those two segments of venture, which are, again, if there's one thing I'd argue for this year, it's almost as though we need a new word for whatever late stage venture has become versus what it, VC is not one thing anymore. And it's kind of tough to talk about it that way. So if you have ideas about how we should change that nomenclature, I'm all ears.
I typically just, I do refer to it as growth equity oftentimes because it's, that is.
I heard the term venture banks the other day and I kind of, I think it was Dan Gray at Equidam. I think that's supposed to be slightly pejorative, but I kind of like it.
I don't know. I mean, I would classify SpaceX as the very late stage VC, and yet we're underwriting that position in part on an expectation of going to Mars. So that seems pretty adventurous to
me. I think we can just leave all Elon companies to one side and talk about it. That's adventure on a totally different scale.
Right, yeah. Right. Okay, well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us. Loved hearing your insights and love reading your reports. Where should people follow you to kind of make sure they have your latest and greatest?
They can find me always on LinkedIn. It's Peter Walker at Carta. Or if you want to read the stuff that we've already published, carta.com/data is where we keep all of our published reports.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.